Hello, Finding Humanity listeners. We have some exciting news to share. Our podcast has just been nominated for the 2022 Webby Awards. The show that you've been supporting since we launched in 2020 has been singled out as one of the 5 best podcasts in the world for public service and activism. But we need your help. The Webby People's Voice Award winners are chosen by listeners like you. Take a minute to vote for Finding Humanity at webbyawards.com. The link is in our show notes and show description. Voting closes on April 21st. Thank you so much for your support.
My mother had had a stroke when I was 19, and she and I were in the middle of arguing with one another. It was a massive stroke, one from which she never fully recovered. I, of course, blamed myself and ran. Did not go home and help like my sisters did. Was not a good daughter to help out. And she sent me a Santa Claus during the holidays that she had made in her ceramics class, which was like an occupational therapy thing to get her movement in her hands back.
That's Carol McDade. Carol started abusing alcohol and drugs when she was a teenager. This affected her relationship with her family. At first, it was hard for Carol to admit that she had an issue.
And I saw that Santa and I realized I was too bad a shape to go home that year for Christmas, which was unusual for me. And our family made a big deal out of Christmas. But I looked bad. I didn't know how I was going to maintain my habit, traveling and all that kind of stuff. I knew that I had somehow made that switch from the regular world to the dark underworld, where people go out more at night than they do in the day. And I was sort of living this double life, and it was really starting to wear on me. That was when I knew I needed help. I've got a drug problem.
This is Finding Humanity, and I'm your host, Hazami Bermada. Through personal stories of courage and purpose, our podcast puts a human face on the most critical human rights and social justice issues facing our world. In each episode, we aim to educate and inspire you to take action. And together, to help create a better world. Carol grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina, in an upper middle class family.
When I was the youngest kid, we wanted for nothing, really, except for maybe some love in the household. But we had all the material things that a kid could want for the most part. I was a 7th generation Irish American person in my family suffering with addiction, just like my father had, his father, and my mother's father, and on, and her brother, and my mother, even some herself struggled. So we had addiction going back for a long, long time, but I'm not the kind of kid that was, you know, hard out on her luck and grew up in poverty or anything like that. If anything, I was academically gifted, played sports, had a lot of friends, but did start using and drinking at an early age because I saw a lot of my older brothers and sisters and those around me doing it. It's definitely like a peer pressure thing.
Carol started drinking when she was 12 and consuming drugs when she was 13. At first, she only smoked marijuana, but she soon moved on to cocaine. By the time Carol was 16, she had started using IV drugs. Like Carol, one in every 10 people in the United States experiences drug addiction. That is equivalent to approximately the entire population of the state of Texas. Over 2% of the world population has an alcohol or illicit drug addiction. According to the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, as of June 2021, over 36 million people suffered from drug use disorders. Despite how prevalent substance abuse disorders are, many still wrongly believe that they occur because of moral weakness.
People believe a lot of times it takes willpower. It's not willpower. It's a complex disease that affects the brain and neurotransmitters and the entire nervous system.
That's Diane Sevening, former president of the Association for Addiction Professionals and assistant professor at the University of South Dakota.
So people who are addicted really struggle. And oftentimes they have this craving because that's the changes that occur in the brain. So they have this intense cravings for the drug. And if they're not able to get that particular drug, they'll use any type of drug to just stop that craving and to prevent withdrawals. So this has really become a significant problem, not only in the United States, but throughout the world.
Another misconception around addiction is that it only affects poor people.
Through all of my research and through all of my years of education, the one thing I can honestly say for true is that drug addiction is an equal opportunity affliction. When you look at different types of drugs, different classes of drugs, you're going to see certain age groups, different demographics. But overall, drug addiction is an equal opportunity affliction. So there isn't one ethnic or socioeconomic group more afflicted than another.
What determines whether someone will develop a substance use disorder is a mix of genetic and environmental factors.
The confusing thing about addiction, and I think the reason why people are so reluctant to spend money to treat it and believe those who have the illness, is because it's multifaceted how you get it.
That's Carol again.
What science tells us today is that there's a genetic component, there's a social component, meaning what you're exposed to, that can light up that gene, like people that have undergone trauma like I did. There were issues with sexual abuse in my early childhood are more likely to develop an addiction. And people who have IV drug use end up having more serious problems with addiction. And there is actual exposure to the drug. And the earlier you take it, the more likely you are to have a problem with it with continued use. And so it's all of those things. It's genetic, it's exposure, and it's things like adverse childhood early experiences.
Carol's environment was conducive to drugs because she was surrounded by people who consumed them in her community, both inside and outside her home. She also had parents who overlooked her addiction.
Letters were coming home as early as 10th grade in high school that there were concerns that I was using drugs. I was in a very small private school where I stuck out amongst a few kids that were using harder drugs. And letters went home saying that, but family was having a hard time remembering or accepting it. And I think the expectation was also, though, with parents at that time, that all the kids were doing it and to kind of look the other way. And that was definitely sort of the view in our household. And I think my parents' marriage was falling apart, and they were preoccupied and distracted by my father's growing alcohol and drug addiction. And I think I also realized the only way you could get attention in our family was to sort of act up. So that was sort of when I started getting into trouble and hanging out with a bad crowd, as my mother would call them, the reform school boys.
Despite this, Carol was a great student. For college, she went to a private school in Atlanta, Georgia.
When I went to college, I was kind of a chameleon. People around me were like following the Grateful Dead, this band, and so got into psychedelics, you know, again, doing a lot of the drugs that people around me did. And then later on, got back into cocaine. I have anxiety too, and the cocaine would accelerate that. So someone gave me a line of heroin one time and told me this would calm me down. So I started mixing those all the time. And that led to, you know, a lot of problems. Later went into crack, and it never occurred to me that I wanted to stop until I started having horrible consequences, as you can imagine, you know, arrest for drunken driving, huge fines that I couldn't afford to pay on my own, getting brought up in front of the honor council for ODing at a frat party in college. I started having consequences. And I also, for the first time with opiates, when I tried to stop on my own, I would get sick. And so that was when I knew, wow, this is really serious. I got a problem here.
Opioids are substances primarily used for pain relief. Although Carol purchased her opioids illicitly, these drugs are often prescribed by medical professionals. In the late 1990s, the use of prescription opioids became widespread after Purdue Pharma and other companies promoted these products heavily. Eventually, it became clear that opioids could be highly addictive, contrary to what these companies claimed. In the U.S., a surge of drug overdoses and suicides linked to opioid drugs even led to a decline of life expectancy in 2015. I spoke to Marta Michelle Colon to better understand opioid addiction. Marta is the founder of Be Gutsy, a national campaign aimed at educating the Latinx community about the dangers of misusing prescription opioids. Marta's brother became addicted to opioids when they were living in Puerto Rico in the mid-2000s.
My brother had a motorcycle accident when he was 16. For his birthday, my dad had decided to give him a motorcycle. And a couple of months after that, he had his first motorcycle accident. And that was just terrible. I mean, he was in the hospital for months. He broke every single part of his body. At the time of my brother's accident, it was interesting because every time he was in pain and screaming and just feeling miserable, we would tell the nurse that he was in this strong pain and he wanted medication and we wanted to make sure that his suffering was not that much. And actually, we had no idea what prescription opioids were. We had no idea of the impact of this medication in his system. We had no idea of the results of misusing opioids. So at the time, for us, we were supporting him with this medication that was prescribed by the doctor because we thought it was his way to ease his pain and he would feel better.
The opioids helped him better deal with his pain. But after a while, Marta noticed that her brother's behavior had changed.
He would be jittery. He would get in a very bad mood. He had mood swings. He would just go into his room and put his music on. His eyes would get crystallized and like bully, like big. It felt that his eyes were going to come out of his eyeballs. Sometimes you would see him very agitated. Sometimes you would see him very passive. He would stop eating. He loved to eat. But then all of a sudden, he would have these periods of eating a lot, not sleeping or sleeping a lot. He was very social and he started becoming more of a lonely person. Like he would not like to spend time with me or with his friends or even with the family. I remember that every time we decided that we were going out to dinner or for a weekend or even on a vacation, he would always say, no, I don't want to go. I would rather stay here. So you could see how his personality and his attitude towards life changed significantly.
When they realized that he was addicted to opioids, Marta and her grandmother did their best to help him. They took him to several medical professionals and treatment centers, but he kept relapsing. His opioid addiction eventually left him on the streets.
I have to say that I went from sadness and pity to frustration and anger towards him and even towards the system. Like I would see him engage in treatment or engage in getting better, and every time he left all these treatments, he would go back on the streets and his substance use disorder would increment. It would get worse. And then I would sit with him and he would say, yes, I want to get better. I want to do it better this time. And this treatment, it's going to help me. And then it would help him just for a brief period of time. And it would go back to the same every 6 months. And I have to tell you that for me, that was very hard. It was heartbreaking because at that time I was frustrated that I just couldn't do enough to save him. I would pay for small apartments for him to be at. And my grandma would like to take him into her home, but he just didn't want that. He just wanted to be on the streets.
Marta was not only frustrated, but she also felt shame around her brother's situation.
And I'll tell you two particular stories. One time when I was coming home, I stopped at a street light with a colleague of mine from work that I was giving him a ride. And my brother was asking for money at that traffic light. And I tell you that and I feel like crying because I cannot tell you what I felt at that moment. But I remember lowering my window and putting money out to give to him, and he actually passed the car and could not make eye contact. It was like he knew there was a lot of suffering in that situation. For me, and even for him, there was suffering. Second story I remember was that he would go house by house asking people for money or for food. And he actually went to my boyfriend's house. And it was my boyfriend's grandmother who said, you know, he has so much resemblance to Martha Michelle. I feel like they're related. So she called me and she asked me. And I have to tell you that at that time, it was very hard for me to actually accept my brother was in such a difficult situation that I just told her that I wasn't sure if it was him. So I didn't want to accept where he was at the moment. I just wanted to keep it silent because I just felt that it actually portrayed something bad about me, that I wasn't doing enough.
Substance abuse can certainly contribute to homelessness, like in the case of Martha's brother. But 70% of people who are addicted to drugs in the United States are actually employed. Carol was one of them. After college, she moved to Washington, D.C. and found a job.
I was working at a very conservative accounting firm in Washington, D.C., you know, back in the day where women wore floppy bow ties around their neck. And, you know, I thought if I dressed like that, nobody would really know that I was having blood on my blouses from shooting up in the bathroom and stuff like that.
It was around that time that Carol's mother sent her the Santa Claus figurine.
And I saw that at Santa and I realized I was in too bad a shape to go home that year for Christmas. I was sort of living this double life where I was juggling, trying to be part of the normal workaday world and this whole nightlife world. And it was really starting to wear on me. My boss had already, you know, was clear she knew something was up. But I had a job where there was a lot of partying and entertaining going on, so I could sort of hide behind that. But that was when I knew I needed help because I was afraid I was going to off myself. I was smoking crack in the shower before work. I mean, it was getting pretty weird.
Carol's boss and her family staged an intervention and asked her to go to a rehabilitation center.
I went because I was told if I didn't go, I would not have my job. And my job was my defining thing in my life. That was the only thing in my mind that I had on my own and that I had created. And it was my identity, that I was this, you know, junior lobbyist type of person.
Carol went to Hazelden Betsy Ford, a rehab center in Florida. It wasn't easy, but she eventually managed to recover from her addiction. Sadly, others struggle for years before they're able to fully recover. Martha's brother was one of those people.
We tried every different treatment center available in Puerto Rico. We tried every psychiatrist available in Puerto Rico. We work with different religions. And we actually found a group of people that were very supportive and actually started helping him see the world with a different perspective.
It was only after Martha's brother stopped feeling judged and through this community that he managed to get back on his feet. He even got a job and moved into a small apartment.
And I remember that I had lunch with him. And he was very happy because the following day, we were going to see another apartment that it was going to be bigger than the one he had. And that with that possibility came the possibility of having a job that was better than the one that he had at the time. So really, he felt that we understood him and he felt that we were not judging him, that we were there every step of the way.
But that night, Martha received a call from a friend.
One morning, it was a Saturday morning around 5 a.m. And I remember I was traveling. And I mean, no one calls anyone at 5 a.m. And as soon as I heard the phone, I knew something had happened with my brother. I have to admit that at first, I was like, oh my God, he had an accident, or, oh, he went back to the streets. But no, it was a friend of ours who was calling me because they were trying to reach him to plan to see this new place where he was going to move, and they were not reaching him. So we decided that we needed to knock his door off and find what was in there. And he was found sleeping in his bed with a meal on his nightstand and his TV on. So he passed in peace. He was eating and he was watching TV, and he was looking forward to the following day to see this new apartment, and he passed. And actually, when he passed and I had to tell my mother and my father, my mother's reaction was that he had overdosed. And I have to tell you, I knew he had not overdosed and he had not go back to where he was in his dark days. So when we got the report, it was actually that all his organs had shut down. And when I spoke to the doctor, he said, you know, he misused opioids for too many years and they keep affecting your system, your heart, your liver, your stomach, your lungs, your everything. So certainly he was doing better, but his body could not take it anymore.
Sadly, Martha's brother is not alone. According to the World Health Organization, globally, around 500,000 deaths each year are attributed to drug use. And more than 70% of those deaths are related to opioids. In the U.S. alone, in 2019, more than 70,000 Americans died from drug overdose, including illicit drugs and prescription opioids. Despite everything she did to help her brother, Martha wishes that she had understood opioid addiction better.
The stigma around substance use, it's terrible. We believe that the people that misuse opioids, they do it because they want to do it. We judge them. We believe that people can snap out of it. And I have to say that I was one of them when I was in my younger years. 20 years later, it's when I really started to learn how we actually need to know more to be able to help people with substance use disorders. Because one is not as easy as turning on your lights. It's not a switch that goes on and goes off. There are other elements. There could be the psychosocial elements. There could be some conditions of your brain. There could be addictive personalities at your home or even at your community. And you can even be going through many situations that make you feel that opioid that you're using would make your life better. So really, I would say the first thing is, let's take the label out. Let's not believe that because someone is using opioids, that person is a junkie. Let's actually see that person as a human being. And let's know more about what are the conditions. Distinguishing, for example, heroin from cocaine, from meth, from prescription opioids. It's important because it would provide us more skills to be able to help someone.
As Martha notes, it is important to get the correct information and to know how to deal with different types of addiction. And recovery looks different depending on the substance and situation of the person struggling with it. Luckily, it didn't take Carol years to overcome her addiction. After spending some time in rehab, she moved back to Washington. She was asked to interview for a job at a government relations consulting firm. When Carol went to the interview, she was handed a list of clients that she would work with. One of them was Hazelden Betsy Ford, the rehab center that she had gone to.
I was like, yeah, I've heard of them. They're a, you know, alcohol and drug rehab. And I thought, well, I've blown this interview. You know, he knows and he's let me know that he's heard that I've, you know, danced on the tables at the Dubliner or something, you know. I was not secretive about my drinking. Yes, about my drug use, but not about my alcohol consumption. And there were a lot of people right there with me in my profession.
But they didn't know, and Carol got the job. Several months into her job, her boss asked her to go to Hazelden with him.
And so I told him in advance of this trip that, Delphi, I've been to Hazelden. And he's like, what'd you do, go out there for a conference? And I said, no, I went there as a patient. He stopped what he was doing. He had been smoking a cigar because people back then smoked in their office. He looked up and he goes, you're an alcoholic? And I was like, yes, and a drug addict. And he's like, God, I'd have never guessed it. You look like the girl next door and, you know, all that. So I'd gotten all these, you know, announcements that I was a vice president at this firm, which was really a jump too high for where I was really professionally. And I thought, oh, my poor mother, she's going to have to tell everyone else she didn't get the job. So, yeah, he goes, Mac Dade, here's the plan. We're going to tell these people that I hired you just to service their account. You're going to become their lobbyist, and then we're going to go get Betty Ford and blah, blah, blah. And then you're going to become the addiction lobbyist in Washington. And while I am certainly not the only addiction lobbyist in Washington by far, especially now, for a while, there was only, you could put us on one hand. But that's not the case today, thankfully. But I definitely followed his career path that day that he laid out for me, and I've never looked back.
In her career, Carol advocates for insurance to cover substance abuse treatments. Her own insurance, which had a generous benefit package, did not cover her time at Hazelden. She was lucky enough to have the money to pay for it, but that's not the reality of most people. It was estimated that in 2017, 20.7 million Americans needed treatment for substance use disorders, but less than 20% received any type of treatment. Globally, less than 10% of people who need such treatment receive it. For this reason, Carol continues to advocate to provide recovery services for people struggling with addiction. But this type of advocacy has been an uphill battle.
We've just not seen the infrastructure investments in this sector that we have seen, let's say, in the HIV/AIDS community. They got so much more money than we ever have. I'd say about 19 to 1 in terms of the spending on HIV/AIDS, which now is basically not a death sentence. You can comfortably live with HIV now. So those investments matter, and we haven't seen that in the addiction space. People give philanthropically to animals at 10 times higher rates than they do to this cause. So it just goes to show you the value, that people value animals more than people who have this particular illness.
Why do you think that's the case?
Well, you know, number one, most people with HIV/AIDS or diabetes do not go and commit crime when they're in the acute phase of their illness. And many of us do to finance our addiction. And unfortunately, that disease has been criminalized, and we get thrown in jail just for being an addict and using drugs in the acute phase of our illness. Number two, people don't ask for help because they've got an illness that tells them they don't have an illness. And I think the third thing is that historically, there have always been a subgroup of people who have needed to be marginalized by others in the community to make themselves feel better about it. People with a disease of addiction tend to be one of those groups that people love to marginalize. But we have to speak up louder because I do think people are not as outraged. I've done my part, all that I can do, to sort of raise the visibility of the issue, to also put a face on recovery, because I think people need to know people do, in fact, get well, even if you have a person in your family that never did.
Carol advocates for the rights of those experiencing mental illness or addiction as the principal of Capital Decisions Incorporated, a government relations firm that she co-founded in 2000. In 2004, she co-founded with her husband, the McShin Foundation, a recovery community organization. Besides advocating for changes at the government level, we must start by understanding addiction as an illness.
I was hoping by this time in this decade that the stigma would be gone, but it isn't.
That's Diane again.
Way back in the past, people were considered criminals if they use drugs. And they had this negative connotation. We've heard this term, skid row alcoholic, they would say, and junkie. So using all of these negative labels and negative terms, and that still continues today. Even with all the education and all the awareness that there is, we need to do far more than that. We need to reduce the stigma because this is, like I mentioned, a complex individualized disease. And people who have this disease are no different than people having diabetes. Those are accepted, where with drug addiction or substance use disorders, and even mental health disorders, they're not accepted. We just need to get people to realize that so many people who are in recovery today are very productive in society, are leaders oftentimes in their community. And, you know, for people to look down on someone who has a disease due to drug use needs to stop, because they don't understand it. And I think that's probably a major concern, is they're not informed. If people would really educate themselves, become informed about it, that we could reduce the stigma.
Letting go of stigma starts in your own community. If you know someone struggling with addiction, Carol has a message for you.
I want you to know that your daughter, who's excelling in everything, she's not exempt from either having or getting an alcohol or drug problem. And to stay tuned in to their life, don't continue to take no for an answer if they're running from you or seeming disinterested in having a conversation. Keep after it, talk anyways, and know that there are resources out there where you can get help more now than ever before. Just don't suffer in silence. You don't have to anymore.
You probably know someone struggling with addiction, whether prescription opioids, alcohol, or other illicit drugs. We must do our part in helping people struggling with this illness. Through our podcast, we aim to educate and inspire you to take action. There are many ways to do that. Here are just a few suggestions. First, if you know someone struggling with addiction, seek help. There are many organizations and online resources to help you navigate sobriety. In the U.S., the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is a good starting point. Second, reach out to your legislators and advocate for better health care and drug policies, such as coverage for recovery services. And third, learn more about drug addiction. We've prepared an educational toolkit on our website to help you deep dive into this issue further. We invite you to host a teach-in for your friends, colleagues, and community. Knowledge is power, and you have the power to inspire real change. If you'd like to hear more empowering stories from Finding Humanity, or to learn more about this episode, visit our website at findinghumanitypodcast.com. Please subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Your ratings and reviews help Finding Humanity reach new audiences, so we thank you for your support. In our podcast, we cover pressing and at times controversial social and political issues. The views and opinions expressed are those of the interviewees and do not reflect the positions or opinions of the producers or any affiliated organizations. Finding Humanity is a joint production of the Humanity Lab Foundation and Human Group Media. For this episode, I'd like to thank Carol McDade, Martha Michelle Quillon, and Diane Sevening. Our co-executive producers are Camille Lorente and Hazami Bermada. Associate producers are Fernanda Oriegas and Tani Jaraprabrasok. Policy and background research by Carolina Mindica and Tani Jaraprabrasok. Mixing, editing, and music by Maverick Aquino. I'm your host, Hazami Bermada. Thank you for listening, and I look forward to seeing you on our next episode.